Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Since the start of the pandemic, calls to the hotline at the National Eating Disorders Association are up 70 to 80%. According to a 2014 article in World Psychiatry, eating disorders have the second highest mortality rate of any psychiatric diagnosis, second only to opioid use disorder. Today on our Healthy Lifestyles program, we focus on eating disorder, who's at risk, and what are the signs, and what supports are available. Joining us is Dina Irwin. She's a registered dietitian and nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods healing and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business, Nourish. Hi, Dina.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Stacey Richmond, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders, practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy for more than 20 years. She provides individual counseling, coaching, workshops, and retreats for women through her business, Kind Eating. Hi, Stacey.
Good morning. Good morning, Dina.
So, good morning, Stacey. How are you?
I'm good.
Stacey, the pandemic has elevated stress and anxiety in people. So what is the link between these emotions and eating?
Well, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about the mind-body-food connection, and food and eating helps us in so many ways, from giving us a sense of comfort, a sense of stability. Our eating routines provide stability and structure. Food and eating, meal times, is also a time to connect socially. So when you think about some of the impact of our current COVID crisis, some of what is happening is those pieces that keep people really centered and grounded in their reality with food and eating is has gotten dismantled a bit.
Yeah. Many people have seen their routines, of course, upended. They've lost social connections. So how does isolation and a lack of structure impact people who might be coping with eating disorders?
So when I, you know, because that's really what my reality is, working with people that are struggling with eating disorders, a lot of times either, and we'll look at this, but there's a spectrum of disordered eating and the way that that may show up for somebody. And for some people, it may mean that they turn towards food as a way to help themselves feel better, to cope, to pass time. Other individuals may find that the way they cope is through avoiding eating. It gives them a sense of comfort, a sense of internal solitude and connection with themselves in a way that food and eating is distressing. So it really depends on how the symptoms may show up for somebody, but people can either move towards food as a way to organize and feel safe and connected, or they may move away. And underlying all of this ultimately is not about the food, but it's the attempt that somebody's making to use food by avoiding or eating as a way to regulate how they feel emotionally. So underneath this, it's really an attempt to comfort and soothe and help them feel better emotionally.
Dina, what are the risk factors for eating disorders?
Well, what we're seeing lately is just the stress and anxiety. I mean, that's a huge risk factor. Trauma is another one, and this is definitely a traumatic kind of global experience for all of us. So those are two of the big ones that we're seeing right now that are impacting the eating disorders. It is. It's really a global kind of problem that we're facing.
Are eating disorders commonly associated with other behavioral health disorders, you know, like depression?
Yes, Dina. There could be a lot of comorbidities associated frequently with disordered eating and eating disorders. There can be depression. There can be obsessive compulsive related disorders. There can also be, as Dina mentioned, trauma and sexual abuse history can also be a secondary concern, not in everybody that has eating disorders, but looking at the impact of trauma as a co-occurring component of looking at disordered eating, those are all absolutely not uncommon.
Yeah. Dina, did you want to add anything?
Well, I was just going to mention that the OCD, as Stacy had mentioned, is really big with eating disorders sometimes. And a lot of times it's, you know, eating is the one thing that people feel like they have control over. So in a world that's kind of lost control, that's one thing that, you know, people find that they can control, and that can really contribute.
I think most people have heard of, you know, anorexia or bulimia. But Stacy, what are the different types of eating disorders?
Well, I think one of the things that interested me in our program today is that the definition of eating disorders has expanded greatly. And often, if I am having a conversation or doing a screening or educating people about eating disorders, there's very little awareness that the definition has broadened into quite an expanse. People frequently think of clinical eating disorders as anorexia and bulimia as the two classic eating disorders, which those, in fact, are clinical eating disorders. And when I reference the term clinical, I will have people, again, imagine a spectrum of disordered eating, and there are some symptoms that are subclinical, but the clinical eating disorders is anorexia nervosa. In addition is bulimia nervosa. Binge eating disorder is another. Newer categories include what's called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And there are other categories that's under what's called other eating disorders. And under that category would be orthorexia, which we have also talked about on this program. And there's also night eating syndrome. Mm-hmm. Night eating syndrome is something that people find quite surprising that it is an eating disorder, because this type of eating pattern isn't uncommon for a lot of people, where the majority of somebody's intake happens between dinner and when they wake up in the morning. So night eating syndrome can be people who wake up in the evening and consume large amounts of food in the middle of the night. Often they may restrict during the day because of eating a large amount of food in the evening. The orthorexia is obsessively focusing on healthy eating, which causes a great deal of disruption in their life, their daily life, and being able to have normalized eating patterns. We might think of that as clean eating and, you know, only eating from certain food categories, organic foods, non-GMO foods, to the extreme, that it causes malnutrition and problems in their relationships with in their life. I wanted to go back to the ARFID, which is the Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. This is a newer category that I think we're going to see a great deal of expansion in. And I'm mentioning this because it can look a lot like picky eating. The characteristics of ARFID are extreme picky eating, which results in weight loss. And the picky eating is related to what we might see as highly sensitive to textures, highly selective based on food fears, based on a negative food experience, such as vomiting or gagging. And it does not include a desire for thinness or weight loss for appearance, like anorexia and bulimia. It's a defining characteristic. So that is an important one that I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
And if there's any other questions about specifically what defines anorexia, bulimia, or binge eating, you know, we can also talk about that as well.
Yeah. So do eating disorders typically manifest in adolescence or young adulthood? When does this begin?
So if we look at, say, risk factors and, you know, look from that lens, the landscape of eating disorders has also changed. Yes, primarily the highest risk time of life is still teenage, young adult age. However, you can see with expanding these definitions that now we're moving that down in age. We look at this ARFID diagnosis more with younger children, more like around the age of 7. And what we're also seeing is adult onset eating disorders, which would be in quotation, middle age, which might be, say, 30 to 60-year-old, and an increasing amount of men also presenting with clinical eating disorders. And we see adolescent and young adult men with eating disorders, but it can also present itself in adults. And I see, what I've seen mostly with the eating disorder spectrum in adult men is more binge eating disorder, not the anorexia or bulimia.
And interestingly enough, I've seen it manifest several times in elderly people.
Oh, is that right?
Especially orthorexia, where they, maybe they get a diagnosis of high cholesterol or something like that, and then they become fixated on avoiding many, many, many foods to the point where they get malnourished.
Yeah. So, Dana, since the pandemic began, are you hearing from people who say they've never had issues around food or eating, but now they're struggling?
Everyone is struggling, yes. And not, many people maybe don't have, wouldn't qualify as a clinical eating disorder, but certainly disordered eating is coming up a lot. People are so hard on themselves. We all beat ourselves up, and, maybe we've been at home, eating a little bit more than usual, and then you get into kind of this rut where then you feel bad about yourself and you beat yourself up over it, and then you keep eating more and you keep thinking bad thoughts about yourself, and it becomes this circle that we try to break.
Yeah. Stacey, are you seeing the same thing?
Definitely. I have had an increase in calls, and I've had an increase in calls from past clients. So not only is it absolutely across the board, as Dina said, everybody's struggling to a degree. Individuals that might have more of a clinical issue are relapsing. There's a high degree of relapse that I'm seeing in my clients. Those that have been stable are getting destabilized. And, we think about the food environment. The food environment now is concentrated for many people within the four walls of their own home. There's a little less food diversity, a little less comfort in going out to eat. So that would bring the experience of having more fun with food into our own home. And sometimes that can be a bit of a challenge if some of the foods that are what I like to call fun foods are foods that are higher in the nutrients that can be a little bit triggering as far as being able to stop easily, especially if we're looking for some emotional comfort. And those would be, of course, the higher carbohydrate foods that are higher in sugar, fat, and salt, or ice cream can be another choice for people. So much of it is driven by it's in the house more because that's where they're going to, where people are sourcing their food. And for the reason of pleasure, comfort, and actually distraction. Food and eating gives people something to do. If you're bored and don't really know what to do with yourself and you can't go out and you meander into the kitchen, eating is an activity. So it's a convenient way to relieve boredom right now.
As Dina, you mentioned, we're kind of beat up on ourselves, but we're all doing it, aren't we? How many times have you found someone in the kitchen going, "What am I doing?" So I think we do often associate young women with eating disorders, but as you're mentioning, men and boys can also suffer from eating disorders. How big of a problem are eating disorders in men and boys? Are they less likely to be diagnosed than women?
Yeah. So in my experience, and of course, clinical research shows us that men and boys, there's a stigma with eating disorders. So there's a lot more guardedness in terms of reaching out for help or addressing eating problems openly, because it is often seen as more of a, quote, female-related issue. In addition, young women are often going to the doctor more, not only for regular physicals, but one of the primary indicators is looking at normal menstrual function. And for a lot of young girls, that can be a very obvious red flag indicator that something is not working well physically, whereas that's not an obvious indicator for males when they go to a physical, unless they have some appreciable weight change, be it weight loss or weight gain, unless they're going to verbalize some of what their concerns are, or somebody asks screening questions, they can often be left out of being identified and invited into an opportunity for treatment.
I also read that boys can be more at risk for dying from eating disorders. Why is that?
Yeah, I saw that you might ask that question, and I'm not sure about that information. I'm not sure if you have some more insight of where you saw that information, because that wasn't something that I was aware of.
Yeah. All right. I'll get that information to you. I don't know if to remember off the top of my head, but yeah.
I don't know if you do have any insight on that.
No, that's so sad to hear that, actually. And you know, that I'm thinking back, like, on the 30 years that I've been a nutritionist, I think I've only seen two men for eating disorders. So maybe it's just that they're not seeking the help.
They're not diagnosed.
We're
talking about eating disorders. Who's at risk? What are the signs and what supports are available? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about eating disorders. Who's at risk? What are the signs and what supports are available? With us is Dina Irwin, registered dietitian and nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. She's also a registered yoga teacher. And Stacy Richmond, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders and practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment or question for us this morning, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. How are people dying from eating disorders? Is it malnutrition or is it something else?
Well, there's a couple of different concerns. The malnutrition, yes, and the secondary effect of malnutrition, which is a cardiac related event. And there's also suicide. And there's also electrolyte imbalance and shifts, especially for somebody who might be have the experience of bulimia and vomiting, or using diuretics and or Ipecac, which is a substance that helps initiate vomiting. So when you have anything that's going to change your physiology, the body biochemistry, rapidly, the increased risk for death is quite high. But as I also mentioned, statistically, suicides are also part of the death rate for eating disorders.
Wow. Athletes can also be at risk for eating disorders. It's something you wouldn't normally think of, right?
Well, you wouldn't think of it, but there's a couple different perspectives to look at the risk factors for athletes. First of all, are the sports that emphasize appearance. So the classic appearance-based sports that drive people to very low body weights to meet weight standards for their sport would be gymnastics. And for men, it's wrestling. For anybody, it could be bodybuilding. Diving is another. Endurance athletes, long-distance runners. Where there is a perception and sometimes a very real fact that a certain body composition can improve and enhance performance, and sometimes that is taken too far and really results in malnutrition. And it's tricky because when we start to look at athletes being very well conditioned, we talk about cardiac risk factors and mortality, is that a very low heart rate is an indicator of being very fit. The question becomes, especially when we're starting to look at, if we look at athletes or somebody that might identify as a potential risk for an eating disorder, is their low heart rate due to their conditioning and their fitness, or is it due to malnutrition? So that gets a little tricky when we start looking at athletes and what their presentation is medically and their risk factors.
Yeah. I have an update for where we got that information about males maybe dying with it. It's from the National Eating Disorders Association. It says males represent 25% of individuals with anorexia nervosa, and they are at a higher risk of dying in part because they are often diagnosed later, since many people assume males don't have eating disorders. So you kind of had that, even though you didn't know where that was coming from. Yeah. So we've seen a rise in celebrity diets and food gurus, which can reinforce the idea that eating only certain foods and avoiding others is a virtue, practically a religion. And you mentioned clean eating. Do we see people who've become too focused on health?
Yes. So that's the orthorexia piece of it. And absolutely, people get so focused on a specific way of eating, and it doesn't matter which one, they get so focused on it that they do become malnourished. And interestingly enough, sometimes it's nutrient deficiencies which are actually contributing to some of the stress and anxiety and mood disorders that people are feeling. So it's kind of like they get stuck in this hamster wheel.
Yeah. Stacey, what are your thoughts on all these celebrity diets and things from the food gurus?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one thing I really would like to say about all diets and people looking for something, whether it's the diet from a celebrity or the diet that's been around forever, is that people are always seeking, they're not really, nobody wants a diet, right? Nobody's looking actually for dieting. Nobody wants a diet and cut out their foods and follow these food rules. And so what I want to say is that all these attempts, whether it's because dieting gone awry, dieting is absolutely an independent risk factor for developing disordered eating, which could then, for vulnerable individuals, lead to an eating disorder. But if we back up and look at, why are people so interested in dieting? Why is this a multi-billion-dollar industry? And why diets are such a concern? Because it is a risk factor. Somebody who's dieting is putting themselves in a vulnerable position to develop a bigger problem. But the reason why everybody, majority of people, whether they're dieting or even somebody who's struggling or a challenge with a clinical eating disorder, it's all in an attempt to find a solution. So, you know, we look at dieting, weight loss, or to the extreme, a clinical eating disorder like a problem. It's actually somebody who's trying to find a solution. And the way that they're seeking to find a solution is through managing their food and eating, working on changing their body, regulating the choices that they're making. Why? So ultimately, the foundation of all of this across the board for pretty much everybody that I meet or work with is people want to feel good. People want to feel better. People want to feel more accepted. People want to feel more attractive. People want to feel that they have value. So, you know, I think it's important to look at for anybody who's listening and, you know, feeling like they are on the diet yo-yo, or they're concerned about their eating, or they're fine, but they're looking at everybody around them who is having problems with eating or is on another diet, to really look at this through the lens of people are doing the best they can to try to find a solution to feel good about themselves and their life. And how can we, you know, start to develop some compassion and start understanding that it's often a futile attempt, but it's not really dieting that people are seeking. It's the result of dieting that they're seeking.
Yeah. Dean, I think you mentioned...
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, and going back to the beginning of our conversation, is the first step is being kind to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, just be kind to yourself.
Dina, you mentioned, I think it was you that mentioned control. So talk about the role control plays in eating disorders.
Yeah, it's just that sometimes it's just the one thing that people feel like they can control in their lives. So it just piece of it just takes over. But I think we can incorporate, I use a lot of my practice, a lot of mindfulness techniques and some yoga, and we kind of incorporate ways to have other control in your life. Mm-hmm. Things like yoga teaches us to embrace the transitions in life and to know that change, the only constant in life is change. So I incorporate a lot of different mindfulness practices and ways that you can have, control in other ways.
Stacey, there's a, as we mentioned, a link between trauma and eating disorders. Could it be people looking to gain or maintain control after experiencing a loss of control in their traumatic experience?
Absolutely. We could absolutely say that that is something that somebody is seeking. And I like to offer a shift in perspective with regard to using that term control. What I like to offer is shifting the perspective to being in charge instead of being in control. Mm-hmm. Because if we're in control, we can be out of control. And a lot of what people experience with disordered eating is feeling out of control, can't control things. But if we can start to work on building skills and tools and learning how to find our own inner resources, our own inner power to learn how to be in charge, being in charge is not that you're out of charge, right? Like, right, there's not the opposite. And so shifting that sense of control or out of control into how to start to take charge and look through that lens of developing skill mm-hmm. building, so that whether it is trauma, and, one of the things that we're all experiencing right now in our culture, this is a collective traumatic experience, right, that we're all experiencing. So you can see how that, as a blanket, can be such a big trigger for people using food to help themselves, because we're all experiencing this big trauma together. And so certainly when we feel out of control, we might want to seek control. But if it's the only way that we're looking through that lens, that means we're always vulnerable to lose control again.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Stacey, on children? I'm thinking, I think I read somewhere one of the things, with children, it's like that's one area where they feel like they are in control or in charge, as you say, I will or will not eat that kind of a thing. What are your thoughts? I often talked to a nutritionist. I remember when my daughter was little, and that whole, as we were kids, clean your whole plate. You get no dessert unless you eat everything on your plate. And I loved, she had said, give dessert in proportion to what she eats. Don't make her eat everything on the plate. And kids, sometimes they're famished, and other times they pick, like, they hardly eat anything. But I thought that was really good advice. So make the dessert, in ratio to what they've eaten for dinner. But what are your thoughts about control in children with eating?
Yeah, so I'd love to reference, for anybody that's interested in a little more information about this, Ellen Satter. And Ellen Satter is a great dietitian-therapist combo, and she has created some wonderful models of quote-unquote normal eating, specifically coaching and educating parents about how to feed children, and she divides it by child's life stage. But some of these overarching principles are what's called the division of responsibility of food and eating. So parents are responsible for what, when, and where, what you buy, what you make, what you offer, what you serve, when, meaning parents are, it's their role to provide structure and regular rhythm of eating, and what, when, and where, meaning what are those designated eating spots? Are you eating in the kitchen? Is it okay to eat in the living room? Can you eat in the bedroom? Like, parents are really the ones to establish that. For children, what their role and responsibility is to decide what they're going to eat based on what's offered. So what you're saying right there is what and how much they're going to eat. So that gets really tricky if those roles get crossed and parents step in a little too much to try to over-regulate the part that kids are responsible for learning to develop. They're responsible themselves to develop a sense of internal connection with their body. And so what happens is, if there's too much external control, trying to control what and how much kids eat, then kids start to eat for the sake of controlling parents. Like, I'm going to eat this mm-hmm. to make them happier. Yep. I'm going to eat this to be belligerent, and because I know it will make my parents angry, and it gives me a sense of ownership over this experience. So you are right. Food and eating, food becomes a potential behavioral dynamic. And there's some really great resources, and one I would direct people to is Ellen, it's E-L-L-Y-N, Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R, and she has a great website.
Great. All right, let's talk to Kristen, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Kristen.
Hi there. Thank you.
Hi,
thank
go
you
ahead.
For putting me on. Can you hear
you
me?
Bet.
Yes.
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Okay, great. So I'm so glad Stacy was just speaking to that about those early years. And in my experience with my own daughter, I was concerned. And our therapist said, you know what, don't focus on what she eats. She's going to eat when she's hungry. And if she doesn't eat what you're eating, that's okay. She's not going to starve. She's going to eat when she's hungry. And, you know, just don't push it. Don't push it. And also, just in my own personal experience, I think that one of the things that contributes, and, you know, also I've read quite a bit about eating disorders and have a lot of personal experience with it. So one of the things is sort of that parental modeling where you are denigrating yourself verbally in front of your children, saying, oh, I'm too fat, or grabbing a piece of stomach and showing, oh, it's 6 inches, you know, or even people just easily dismissing or devaluing someone based upon size. Like, you know, there's always like this pretty face, but she's, you know, too bad. She's,
yeah. Oh yeah, Kristen. That's a good point. And Dina, I think that goes back to your all of like not only be kind to yourself, but be kind to others, right?
Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Stacey, you want to say anything about Kristen's
yes,
comments?
I do. You know, family of origin is one of the significant influencers in terms of values, ideas, and beliefs about food, eating, and body image, and dieting. And Kristen, thank you so much for your call, because there's so much here in terms of really how can we then look at prevention, and what are some supportive ways for us to look at our family system to prevent issues and problems, because that's the best treatment is prevention. So we start to look at family systems, and, you know, a child literally came from the body of a mother and a father. And so when you think about the messages that parents give about body size, shape, food, and eating, and or how they treat their own body, unconsciously, mm-hmm. children absolutely will look at them at themselves and say, well, you know, if my mommy thinks that she's big and I think she's beautiful, well, then what does mommy think about me? So,
right.
You know, those messages, absolutely, they come up in sessions a lot in terms of body size, shape, or dieting. If somebody in the family has just dieted and lost a lot of weight, that influences children thinking like, well, you know, maybe I'm not acceptable anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kristen brought up another point where she said she was told, don't make the kids eat when they're not hungry. And we have a little rule, and we had when my daughter's in now with my grandson. You don't have to eat at dinner, but you have to come to the table and sit with us. You
exactly.
don't have to eat a thing, but you have to
exactly.
be there, because that's when we have the conversations about our day and what have you. So that's another good point is you know, because kids go through stages, right? Sometimes they're, you know, they go through what we call growing spurts, right, where they're eating everything in sight, and then, you know, they kind of back off on it. So I guess we kind of have to pay attention to that.
I just would like to piggyback on, I'm so sorry, Dina, but one thing just that Kristen said, because this is, I've been in practice for a really long time, and that comment that Kristen made about, you know, absolutely just, you know, leave the children, they'll eat when they eat. I just want to comment that, you know, that absolutely was way more pertinent 25 years ago. And what I want to say is now, if you have a child that might consistently not participate in eating, even though you're offering the food, and they might be really picky, I would say that we're seeing with some of these eating disorders that have developed, that some of that could be a concern. And if you find that there's a pattern, a consistent pattern of children not showing up and not eating, even if, you know, the food is offered, I would say to do some weight monitoring, because it isn't 100% the case for all children. especially now with more stress and anxiety in our culture. There's more food-related focus, body image-related focus, and these newly developed eating disorders. So I would say absolutely that is 100% my philosophy, but I would like to also say that it's not always the case in the way that it might have been years ago.
Okay. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about eating disorders with Dina Irwin, registered dietitian and nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods healing with and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business Nourish. And Stacy Richmond, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders, practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy. And she also provides individual counseling, coaching, workshops, and retreats for women through her business, Kind Eating. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Advertising, movies, and TV have always depicted flawless, toned, and beautiful people, but it seems to reach a new level because now we also have, you know, the social media that, you know, everybody's looking at. So even if we know these are idealized versions of reality, how do these images impact how we view ourselves or perhaps lead us to judge others?
Yeah, I'm just going to go back to be kind to yourself again. And, you know, we are all beautiful. And I think that's starting to change. I think we're starting to see a wide variety of images of people in different shapes and sizes and colors, which is really nice. I hope that trend continues, that we're all unique individuals and we're all beautiful.
What you hear from some of the young men and women that you work with about the pressures they feel from their peers or society?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of different viewpoints on that. That, you know, first of all, any one of us, right? We're all human to some degree, and think about whatever our own vulnerability might be. If we have some idea, image that we see that represents something that's not close to what we think is ideal for us, how does it make us feel? It doesn't make us feel good. And studies show that exposure for young adults and teenagers to media messages of thinness and ideal, be it for women, men, results in low body satisfaction and lower self-esteem. So, you know, these images that we're exposed to in advertising and now through social media is one aspect. The other is peer pressure. And that, of course, the social media platforms, people are going to put images on there that present themselves in the best light. And so often we might be comparing ourselves to what somebody might present as the best version of themselves. And internally in our own mind, we're thinking of the least desirable version of ourselves. So we're really there's a lot of distortion in the way that we view imagery and how it impacts our sense of self. And it is significant with this current generation because it's not just one platform. You know, in terms of media, I think the statistics are 5 hours a day average television and 6 to 7 hours of other mixed media. So when you think about all of the obvious programming from people scanning all their different accounts, and, you know, one of the interventions that I work on with clients is asking them about their social media accounts and challenging them to take a break, Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to say 95% of everybody who takes a break and freezes their accounts or Instagram accounts, their Facebook accounts, absolutely experience a significant lift in their sense of self and their success in treatment.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, let's talk to Janet, who's calling from Mashpee.
And also stress and anxiety, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk to Janet, who's calling from Mashpee. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a quick comment about other health issues. I have celiac disease. So as a child and growing up, I was extremely thin, and people always assumed I was anorexic, and they would make comments. And I was eating a lot of food. I just didn't know I had this illness. And so I was always very thin because I didn't get the proper nutrition from my food. And that was just an autoimmune disease. So I think it's just really important not to prejudge people about their body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Janet, such a good point. Yeah.
Janet, thank you so much for your call, because I've worked with a lot of people over the years who come to me with your exact concern. And it's really hard for people to wrap their brain around somebody who has a difficult time with weight restoration due to a clinical concern. I liken it to the same level of effort and challenge as somebody who may have a larger body who's trying to lose weight for health reasons. It's the same level of concern, same level of effort. And it's mm-hmm. not easy for somebody who has some challenges metabolically due to, say, celiac or other medical conditions, to actually eat enough food so that they can be healthy. And a lot of people don't understand or don't have that perspective. So thank you so much for calling in to share that.
Yeah, thanks, Janet. At various times in our lives, many of us think we could lose a little weight, or maybe we go on a diet or we take up a new exercise routine to shed the pounds. What are some warning signs that we're becoming too focused on our weight or what we're eating?
Mm. Well, I think when it's when it interferes with your life, when you're obsessing about your weight, when you're getting on the scale 2 or 3 times a day, when you don't have enjoyment in what you're eating, those are just a couple of the things. I spend a great deal of time working with folks on learning how to stop dieting. And how to, stop getting on the scale and on dieting, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Stacey, do you have anything
else? Yeah, sure. Thank you for that. And I'll just thank you. I'll piggyback onto some of that. So absolutely that we were talking about the subclinical or disordered eating would be more like that frequent dieting. So if you're finding that there's a lot of on and off, people who start to withdraw from social situations because they're trying to avoid eating, unplanned foods or foods they're not in charge of, skipping meals altogether is a huge red flag. Food rituals, I'm only going to eat this food at this time, is another. So it's basically, in general, moving from a very flexible, relaxed experience of food and eating, the more inflexible, rigid, and stressed you become about eating, that is a great general symptom that is problematic. Then we also have physical, just the physical symptoms, sleep abnormalities, especially if we've got people making changes with their food, their sleep patterns are thrown off, they have a lot more emotional distress, they're not able to cope with their emotions, they might find they're very impulsive, either behaviorally or with their emotional responses. They may be dizzy, they may be fainting, they may have digestive-related issues. So there's some psychological and also some physical, and of course, weight fluctuation for big weight fluctuations going up or down.
Stacey, our relationship with food can become so complicated and layered. It's about body image, relationships, emotion. If we want to have a healthier relationship with our bodies and food, so where do we start?
I love Gina's planting her seed of mindfulness. So I think that I know that that is an often overused term, or that people might not really think of the fundamentals of that. But what I would say is to slow down. Everybody is moving very fast. They're thinking very fast. And when our mind is moving very quickly and we're caught in negative thinking, we can get caught in negative thought loops that can evoke negative feeling states. And we can get very disconnected from reality. And so what I would say is to slow down, start to slow down, breathe, get some perspective. Sometimes if somebody really is concerned, doing some journaling, some self-reflection, I'm curious, what am I eating? What does this look like? How am I feeling about that? So some self-awareness exercises are absolutely essential to gain some perspective for yourself. So any way that you can gain perspective, be in nature, journaling, just doing some mindful breathing, maybe some, if somebody's into yoga, doing a few poses at home. You don't have to go to sign up for a full class, but anything that you can do to slow down, to start connecting with yourself, because we haven't really talked a lot about, say, the component of a treatment model, but I know for Dina and myself, we really work with whole person approach and that we're multidimensional beings, and that part of treatment and healing from disordered eating not only is physical, emotional, but there's also a spiritual component to it.
Yeah. Dina, you want to add anything to that?
I agree, absolutely. And when we do slow down, we really get a sense to listen to our bodies and find out, well, what are our bodies asking for. Some people don't realize their hunger and fullness signals. So just, you know, learning to eat intuitively based on when you're hungry. But that slowing down is really helpful. There is a book that I like to use with folks. It can be kind of used as a workbook and some journaling. It's called Well Nourished by Andrea Lieberstein. That's an excellent resource for people.
You know, it's funny when you talk about slowing down. I don't know if I've told the story before, but years ago I was part of this sort of like a mindfulness retreat thing. And we're doing these exercises, and it was like time to break for lunch. And you're like, oh, and you think you're going to be chatting with everyone. Well, no, the assignment was we were to eat lunch in complete silence. Mm-hmm. And then we would go outside and walk the grounds again in complete silence. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised how much tastier my lunch was when I was really focused on the eating. So that idea of slowing down and just kind of being more mindful really is amazing.
It is. Oh, yeah, and food should be enjoyable. So I'm so glad you got a chance to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Definitely. I do a lot with mindful eating with people and really slowing down and using all of your senses to enjoy food.
Yeah. And of course it is the holidays and we are all going to be a little bit bad. This is the time of year where we're eating all those kind of annual things that we only eat around the holidays. And I guess, Dina, as you're saying, give ourselves a little break, right? Just be kind, enjoy it.
Without eat it, enjoy it mindfully without judgment. Absolutely.
Stacey, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, thank you. Heading into the holidays, with regard to thinking about the difference between feeding yourself and nourishing yourself, and that nourishment isn't just about eating all the right foods at the right time, that nourishment is about time with people, choosing delicious, yummy foods, perhaps, again, special foods that are made for your family during the holidays. To let yourself think about food and eating beyond just the food and your body, but what is the food doing for you? It's satisfying, it's soothing, it's comforting, it's creating connection. So to let yourself start expanding into the definition of feeding oneself as more of nourishing ourselves.
Stacey Richmond, registered dietitian specializing in eating disorders and practitioner of integrative nutrition therapy. She provides individual counseling, coaching, workshops, and retreats for women through her business, Kind Eating. Dina Irwin, registered dietitian and nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods healing and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business, Nourish. We'll post links with more information about Stacey, Dina, and we'll also have a link to Ellen Satter's Healthy Eating in Children at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you, ladies, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.